Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for August the 26th, 2018. This is our weekly look at the world of politics and policy as we take a look at City Hall, the State House, as well as the White House. Time to grab that Sunday paper, get that cup of coffee. We'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. And good morning to Don Kleppen and to Andy Mazur. Happy Sunday, folks.
Happy Sunday.
Right back at you.
You know, Andy, I didn't know what to make of the Bears game, you know? It's preseason, you know, everybody needs their time in. I don't know. They won.
Yeah, they did win 27-20 against the Chiefs yesterday. But, you know, I think you have to look past all the, I guess, the talk of the fact that they didn't play their starters in the game at all. And normally this is the tune-up game. So you'll see the starters play about a half, and then you'll get the backups to go in there for the second half of the game. And, you know, you get a little game feel because the last game of the preseason is always for the guys that are on the bubble and trying to make the make the team. But I kind of understand, after listening to Matt Nagy talk a little bit yesterday about what they're doing in practice compared to what the Bears have done in practices over the last few years with defensive-minded coaches at the helm. They've replicated about 2,500 snaps.
Wow!
During their training camp. So I think his mentality is this: if Trubisky can understand the language and execute the plays in practice, why wouldn't you expect him to be able to do it in a game? And now we can keep him healthy.
Two important things.
Mm-hmm.
Two
important
things. And I don't know, but when you start out against Green Bay.
Yeah, it's true.
Nationally broadcast game. There's a lot of pressure going on.
Yeah, you know, and the Bears aren't the only ones doing this. The Rams have not even used their starting quarterback, Jared Goff, at all.
Really?
He hasn't played.
I don't know that I understand that.
Yeah, I think it's the same concept because, you know, you'd hate to lose a franchise-type quarterback in a preseason game. And I think what these coaches are trying to tell everybody in a roundabout way is that preseason is way too long.
I think it is.
Or there's too many games.
There's too many games, I think.
Yeah.
I could see, you know, obviously you want to try to simulate game conditions as best you can.
Right.
But you're never going to do it perfectly. But it is too long.
It's too long, and you know, I think coaches these days, you know, and the Bears had 5 weeks because of the Hall of Fame game, and
right.
They also got in early because the NFL rule that allows you to get back to camp a week earlier if you have a new head coach. So they've been going at it for a while here, and you know, it's overkill at certain points. What else can you do?
Right.
I mean, what else can you really do? What other wrinkles can you put in?
It had to feel good for Nagy, though, to beat Kansas City, you know, coming from there, you know, and you know, showing Andy Reid, like, hey, man, I can do this, too.
My backups can beat your number one.
That's right, exactly.
And, you know, he was classy about it because he called Andy Reid as they were getting on the plane from Kansas City here to Chicago and to say, hey, listen, I'm not playing my ones. So just so you know, I'm not going to – just so you don't get here and find out that Trubisky's not playing, I don't want you to be surprised about it, so here, they're not playing.
Oh, wow, that is a big man move, I think.
That's nice,
a
cool thing very nice. And, of course, it's preseason.
True.
you won't get any of that advice during the regular season.
No, not at all.
Well, Daniel Murphy, I mean, how about this guy?
Yeah, back-to-back days with home runs, and Schwarber with a home run yesterday, Javi Baez with a home run yesterday. Quintana looked okay, better than Quintana has looked in a while. He has his first win since the very beginning of this month, and the Cubs are getting hot at the right time. Four in a row, and now they have a four-game lead on the Cardinals.
And it's amazing how the Reds had owned the Cubs.
Yeah.
And now, you know, they're going for the sweep today.
going for the sweep on the north side.
Excellent. A great White Sox game yesterday.
Yeah, how about that? I think we're starting to see the fruits of the labor of young pitching trying to discover itself a little bit, because Lucas Giolito was really up and down at the beginning of the year. He had a couple of good starts to start with, and then went into the tank, and it kind of rose up again, and then it went back down to the tank. But the last three or four starts for him have been lights out, and he pitched seven really strong innings yesterday. It helped that they got some offense for him at the beginning as well. And you're going to hear a lot about this story, so let me tell you about it real quick here. Kevin Smith, the White Sox catcher, had a very close relationship with a former White Sox farmhand, Daniel Webb, who passed away tragically in the offseason in an ATV accident. They came up through the AA ranks and AAA ranks together. And during Players Weekend, he's been wearing Webby on his jersey. That's they can choose their own nicknames
right.
for the Players Weekend. And he hit a home run on the first pitch he saw. First time he's played during Players Weekend was yesterday. And hit a two-run homer and could barely keep it together going around the bases because he was thinking about his teammate.
Wow. That's...
Man.
So you'll hear a lot about that story today. We'll recap it also in our pregame show today, which starts at 11:35.
Yeah. Gives you a lot to think about, doesn't it?
Yep.
Big triathlon day today. Lots of road closures. Interesting navigation here to the Skyline Studio today.
Oh, yeah.
Not exactly sure I would say this is the optimal weather for a triathlete today.
No.
No way. So muggy. It's
93% humidity. The swim has got to be nice.
Yeah, right. And then you get out and it still feels like you're swimming, though, because the
air
is just humid.
It'd be nice if that was the last portion of the triathlon.
Yeah, cool off a little
totally.
Bit.
Well, I got to tell you guys, I was, of course, down at my underground hangout there across from the old Tribune Tower. I've seen a lot of bizarre stuff, you know, over the years over there. We actually were having a going away party for my colleague Monique Garcia, who was our State House correspondent in the Tribune, and I was leaving and someone pointed out to me that at a table, not part of the festivities, but at this table, there was a woman seated across from a doll.
Okay.
Whoa.
And she was trying to feed cheeseburgers to the doll and taking pictures or video of it.
Okay.
What?
Yeah. It reminded me of some kind of really bizarre Twilight Zone episode.
Yeah. did Alfred Hitchcock come out of the corner there as well?
I mean, I just kind of looked there dumbfounded, and as did a number of my friends.
I bet.
And, yeah, we decided maybe it's time to depart.
did she have the cheeseburger cut up, or was she just force-feeding the whole thing?
She would take a bite, and then she would reach over to give the doll a bite, and then she would pick up her smartphone and, like, shoot a video or something.
Have you searched the web yet for
No.
Doll, a cheeseburger.
Yeah.
My God. There's probably a whole Instagram account.
I'm looking right now. Hang on.
Dedicated.
Beware of any friend requests you get there.
Right. Polly around town.
I mean, just... And then, of course, I don't know, maybe this was because of the karma that... The air conditioning went out in the place yesterday. So it could be interesting. They can probably grill the cheeseburgers without turning the grill on.
Just throw it on the floor, yeah.
Oh. Well, there have been a few of those back in the day, yes. things being thrown on the floor over there.
Oh, I bet.
But yeah, so that... Just kind of picture that in your mind and then try and wash it out of your head, okay?
I cannot unpicture it now.
Yeah,
it's
just,
in there.
Well, Don Kleppen's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy's got the latest sports. We've got producer Tom, who is here today. Producer Cassara celebrating her birthday. You can call us at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob's wondering why he didn't get the day off. Well, remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes. Just search for my name, Rick Pearson. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, after the news and sports at 7:30, we'll speak to State Representative Emmanuel Chris Welch, a Democrat from Hillside. He's the chairman of the House Higher Education Appropriations Committee, and he's had a couple of hearings down in Edwardsville and Carbondale about the future of the Southern Illinois University system, and it could lead to whether a breakup is in store involving those two universities. We'll also talk about higher ed in general. We'll catch up on the news and sports at 8 o'clock, and then we'll speak to my Chicago Tribune colleague, Mike Hawthorne. Mike's been covering these new EPA rules from the White House that are aimed at helping coal country despite the effects of carbon emissions. We'll find out what that all means. After a final check of the news and sports at 8:30, we'll turn our attention again to SIU, though this time we'll be speaking to SIU Professor John Jackson. He's part of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute, and he's also the co-author of a study on the politics of regionalism and where, in fact, do the tax dollars go. And as we see in every election, politicians trying to pit one area of the state against the other. Well, here's a study that shows something, some revealing facts about where the tax money goes and who does get shortchanged and all of that. That's all coming up, but right now, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Well, we, of course, last night had the passing of a true American hero. Arizona Senator John McCain lost his battle with brain cancer. A military veteran, a prisoner of war, a senator for three decades, a presidential contender, a conscience for many, and a voice for many more. Tributes are pouring in from across the world, across the nation, and across the aisle. But John McCain gave a summation of his life and public service in 2008 in a hockey rink in St. Paul, Minnesota, where he accepted the Republican presidential nomination.
I was in solitary confinement when my captors offered to release me. I knew why. If I went home, they would use it as propaganda to demoralize my fellow prisoners. Our code said we could only go home in the order of our capture, and there were men who had been shot down long before me. I thought about it, though. I wasn't in great shape. I missed everything about America, but I turned it down. A lot of prisoners had it much worse. A lot of prisoners had it a lot worse than I did. I'd been mistreated before, but not as badly as many others. I always liked to strut a little after I'd been roughed up to show the other guys I was tough enough to take it. But after I turned down their offer, they worked me over harder than they ever had before for a long time, and they broke me. When they brought me back to my cell, I was hurt and ashamed. And I didn't know how I could face my fellow prisoners. The good man in the cell next door to me, my friend Bob Craner, saved me. Through taps on a wall, he told me I had fought as hard as I could. No man can always stand alone. And then he told me to get back up and fight again for my country. And for the men I had the honor to serve with, because every day they fought for me. I fell in love with my country when I was a prisoner in someone else's. I loved it not just for the many comforts of life here. I loved it for its decency, for its faith, and the wisdom, justice, and goodness of its people. I loved it because it was not just a place, but an idea, a cause worth fighting for. I was never the same again. I wasn't my own man anymore. I was my country's.
That's John McCain accepting the 2008 Republican presidential nomination. That's John McCain, who passed away last night at the age of 81. He's asked for, at his services, eulogies to be delivered by George W. Bush, who defeated him for the nomination in 2000, as well as Barack Obama, who defeated him in that 2008 race. Donald Trump was pointedly not invited. This would be the same Donald Trump who referred to the fact that he didn't believe that John McCain was a hero because heroes don't get caught. And it's probably appropriate that Donald Trump doesn't show up because look at the week that he had. Almost side by side, the president's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, was convicted by a federal court jury, while Trump's former personal lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, pled guilty to campaign finance violations, such as paying off a porn star for her silence at the direction of the president in order to further his presidential campaign. The president appeared on his favorite news program, Fox and Friends, where he told co-host Ainsley Earnhardt that basically there'd be hell to pay in the U.S. economy if he were to get impeached.
I don't know how you can impeach somebody who's done a great job. I'll tell you what, if I ever got impeached, I think the market would crash. I think everybody would be very poor, because without this thinking, you would see numbers that you wouldn't believe in reverse.
Now, Trump used that appearance on Fox and Friends to also deny that he directed payments be made to women to keep them silent, though that's what Michael Cohen said. And we now have the head of the National Enquirer Company, who is also receiving immunity for testimony. You also have the president, a major head, a top confidant of the president in the Trump Organization, who is speaking with authorities. So that's where you have that. But here's what the president said.
Later on, I knew. Later on. But you have to understand, Ainsley, what he did. And they weren't taken out of campaign finance. That's a big thing. That's a much bigger thing. Did they come out of the campaign? They didn't come out of the campaign. They came from me, and I tweeted about it. You know, I don't know if you know, but I tweeted about the payments. But they didn't come out of campaign. In fact, my first question when I heard about it was, did they come out of the campaign? Because that could be a little dicey. And they didn't come out of the campaign, and that's big. But they weren't, it's not even a campaign violation. If you look at President Obama, he had a massive campaign violation, but he had a different attorney general, and they viewed it a lot different.
And that's exactly not correct, because there were two separate issues involving a campaign violation by the Obama camp and this. It's a study of contrast today. There's the President of the United States, and there's America saying goodbye to John McCain. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
Tick, tock.
The heat waves are on borrowed time. The tan lines are as good as they're going to get. On summer is ticking. Enjoy every minute of it, but start getting ready for the fun you have with ICE. Chicago Blackhawks regular season single game tickets are on sale now. Grab the games you want by going to chicagoblackhawks.com. Just go to chicagoblackhawks.com. Even after summer, the heat goes on.
Message and data rates may apply. Attention all men 40 or older. You can now get a complimentary bottle of award-winning Nugenix, the number one selling free testosterone booster at GNC. Just text RULE to 42424. Here's the harsh reality of getting older. Once you hit 40, your body has less free testosterone. It's not your fault. It just happens. But you don't have to accept it. Be a man of action. Text RULE to 42424 right now to get your complimentary bottle of Nugenix, powered by Testofen, a patented key ingredient clinically researched to help a man feel stronger, leaner, more energetic, and even more passionate. Don't be like those other guys who just accept having less free testosterone. Get back in the game with Nugenix. Feel stronger with a lot more energy and drive. And guys, she'll like the difference too. Get your complimentary bottle today by texting RULE to 42424. Nugenix samples are not available in stores. To get your complimentary bottle, text RULE to 42424. That's RULE to 42424. RULE to 42424.
Up ahead on your Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to Representative Emmanuel Chris Welch. He's a Democrat from Hillside. He's chairman of the House Higher Education Appropriations Committee. He's also part of the Higher Education Working Task Force that's in Springfield that's trying to figure out a new direction for higher education after the decimation that it suffered over the historic state budget impasse. We'll be talking to him about higher ed as well as controversy involving the Southern Illinois University system and its two campuses in Carbondale, its flagship, and in Edwardsville. That's up ahead. Right now, though, it's 7:30. Time for the news. Here's Don Kleppen.
Thank you, Rick. At least six people were killed, including four children, in a fire early today in the Little Village neighborhood on the southwest side. The fire broke out in a three-story apartment building about 4 a.m. in the 2200 block of South Sacramento, according to Chicago Fire Media Affairs and Police. The fire department reported five children and two adults had died in the fire. Police said the fatalities included four kids and two adults. Two other children were transported to local hospitals, the department said. They were in critical condition. Iran's defense minister is in Syria for talks on boosting cooperation. He's expected to meet with President Bashar al-Assad. Iran has been a key ally to Assad in the seven-year civil war there, sending thousands of soldiers and military advisors for support. Iran's state-run press TV quoted Defense Minister Amir Hatami today as saying he hopes Iran can play a productive role in Syria's reconstruction. Israel has expressed concern over Iran's growing influence there. And after a British couple died mysteriously, experts are testing food, water, and air conditioning systems at an Egyptian resort hotel, according to travel company Thomas Cook. Chief Executive Peter Fankhauser pledged to get to the bottom of what happened to John and Susan Cooper, who died at the Steigenberger Aqua Magic Hotel in the Egyptian Red Sea Resort of Hurghada. The couple's daughter said she was suspicious about the deaths because her parents had been in perfect health hours before they died. Fankhauser also told Sky News today the tests would take 10 days to finish, and there's no evidence of carbon monoxide poisoning. Thomas Cook evacuated 300 guests from the hotel after it was discovered 13 customers had food poisoning. Sports, traffic, and weather next on WGN.
You deserve the wedding you've always dreamed of. You deserve natural, unsurpassed beauty, limestone bluffs, cascading waterfalls, complete with a horse-drawn carriage. You deserve all-inclusive, full-service dinner and dancing in a historic reception lodge and relaxation in cozy log cabins. You deserve the magic of White Pines Resort, just 90 minutes west of Chicagoland, nestled in White Pines Forest State Park in Oregon, Illinois. Book your fairy tale wedding today at whitepinesweddings.com. Take a deep breath. You need a break from the chaos of every day. You need cozy cabins, campfires, s'mores, and ghost stories under the stars. You need White Pines Resort in Oregon, Illinois, just 90 minutes west of Chicagoland. Nestled in the heart of White Pines Forest State Park, you'll find relaxation, homestyle cooking, live entertainment, and memories to cherish. Stay in a real log cabin midweek for only $99. Go to whitepinesresort.net and book your escape today.
For a look at WGN Sports, here is Andy Mazur.
Dan DeMurphy and Kyle Schwarber each with two-run homers. Javi Baez adds a solo shot. The Cubs 10-6 win over the Reds at Wrigley yesterday. Murphy homering for the second straight day. Cubs and the Reds wrap up their series this afternoon. Cubs now a season-high 22 games over 500. They lead the Central by four games over St. Louis. Lucas Giolito gave up just one run in seven innings in the White Sox 6-1 win over the Tigers. Kevin Smith, his first home run of the season. Yoan Moncada, a couple of hits, as did Jose Rondon and Matt Davidson. Final game of the four-game series today. I'll have your pregame at 11:35. Ed and DJ with the call around 12:10. Michael Kopech makes his second big league start. Bears coach Matt Nagy decided to rest the starters for the next to last preseason game rather than use it as the customary regular season tune-up. Backups beat the Chiefs 27-20 at Soldier Field. Second-string QB Chase Daniel finishes 15 of 18 for 198 yards and a couple of touchdowns. Kevin White caught one of those, and the Bears will close out the preseason Thursday hosting the Buffalo Bills. Hawaii advanced to the Little League World Series championship game, winning the U.S. title. Hawaii will face South Korea for the championship today. And at the PGA's Northern Trust, Bryson DeChambeau, a four-shot lead over Keegan Bradley as the final round gets underway later on today. On the home of the Blackhawks, Northwestern Wildcats and White Sox baseball, Andy Mazur, WGN Sports.
Thank you, Andy. And news, by the way, sponsored by PermaSeal Basement Systems. Checking WGN traffic, no real delays out there on the roads yet. Just some closures to remind you of. Southbound Lakeshore Drive closed pretty much all the way from Rogers Park down into the loop for the Chicago Triathlon. In the West Loop, Halstead closed both ways from Van Buren to Monroe because of the Taste of Greektown. That's until 5 a.m. tomorrow. On the north side, or on the west side, actually, Ukrainian Days has Chicago closed from Western to Levitt. That's also until 5 tomorrow morning. On the inbound, Stevenson at LaGrange, some road work there has the southbound entrance ramp from LaGrange closed until 10, so another 2.5 hours on that closure. And then Grant Park, Columbus also closed from Roosevelt to Balbo for that triathlon. That is until tonight at 7. And Lower Wacker also closed from Congress to Lakeshore Drive until 11:20, a little bit later this morning there. For personalized traffic on demand, get the Traffic's Chicago app, approved by the mortgage experts of Team Hochberg. Just search TRAFFIX Chicago. The forecast from the WGN Chicago Weather Center today: partly cloudy skies, a stray shower or thunderstorm possible, high of 93, humidity sticking around, same thing tomorrow. Tonight, scattered thunderstorms early, then partly cloudy after midnight, low of 76, and then tomorrow, partly cloudy skies, a stray shower or thunderstorm possible, high of 92. It is 74 degrees at O'Hare, 75 at Midway, 69 in Winnetka, and downtown along the lakefront, 75 degrees. I'm Don Kleppen in the WGN Radio Newsroom, and this is the stuff that matters on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. In that Fox and Friends interview that the president conducted last week, he basically said he doesn't blame his former personal attorney and fixer, Michael Cohen, for taking a plea deal to provide information to special counsel Robert Mueller. But Trump said getting people to flip on others in exchange for a reduced sentence ought to be illegal.
One of the reasons I respect Paul Manafort so much is he went through that trial. You know, they make up stories. People make up stories. This whole thing about flipping, they call it. I know all about flipping. For 30, 40 years, I've been watching flippers. Everything's wonderful, and then they get 10 years in jail, and they flip on whoever the next highest one is, or as high as you can go. It almost ought to be outlawed. It's not fair. Because if somebody's going to spend 5 years like Michael Cohen, or 10 years or 15 years in jail because of a taxicab industry, because he defrauded some bank, the last two were the tiny ones. You know, campaign violations are considered not a big deal, frankly. But if somebody defrauded a bank and he's going to get 10 years in jail or 20 years in jail, but if you can say something bad about Donald Trump and you'll go down to 2 years or 3 years, which is the deal he made. In all fairness to him, most people are going to do that. And I've seen it many times. I've had many friends involved in this stuff. It's called flipping, and it almost ought to be illegal.
He's known a lot of flippers over the years. Those are his words. During that Fox and Friends interview, co-host Ainsley Earhart asked the president if he really thought that the media was the enemy of the people. The president says no, just 80% of it's fake news. Here's the president.
Is the press the enemy of the people?
No, not at all. But the fake news is. And the fake news is comprised of, it's a lot, it's a big chunk, okay? Somebody said, what's the chunk? I said, 80%? It's a lot. It's a lot. If I do something well, it's not reported. Other than in the 20%. I mean, the New York Times cannot write a good story about me. They're crazed. They're like lunatics.
That's your president of the United States. Well, we're going to switch gears now, and joining me on the phone is Democratic State Representative Emmanuel Chris Welch from Hillside. He's chairman of the House Higher Education Appropriations Committee. Representative, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Rick, good morning. Always a pleasure.
Well, welcome back from downstate. I know that you were at a couple of hearings involving the SIU system, one in Carbondale and one in Edwardsville. And, I mean, this, I went to both. And so this seems like a very troubling situation, the fate of where these two schools are headed, the internal disputes between them involving financing. And also, I wonder if it speaks to the larger issue of just another reflection of what the problems are in higher ed after the after that budget impasse.
Yeah, Rick, I got to tell you, it's real interesting. And, you know, one of the things I got to see for myself and hear for myself was from people just like you who actually attended both Carbondale and Edwardsville campuses. And it's a real emotional roller coaster that a lot of folks down there are on. And to me, listening to everything from everyone, it all comes back to the serious disinvestment in higher education that's been going on in the state of Illinois since 2001. I noted the timeline, and I don't think it's coincidental that Representative Jay Hoffman from the Metro East area, a good friend of mine, he filed legislation in 2003, 2013, and again this year in 2018 that dealt with the separation of those campuses. And I don't think it's coincidence that it coincides with the disinvestment of higher education in Illinois that's been going on since 2001, and also the punch in the gut that all higher education institutions took with the budget impasse for 2.5 years under Bruce Rauner. And we have to turn that around and, as a state, say that all of these campuses are important to us and start putting money back into them. Because right now they're just fighting over the scraps, Rick.
Well, when I went to SIU Edwardsville, it's vastly different now than the campus I attended when it was almost a glorified commuter campus. They had very little student housing, huge parking lots where I got plenty of parking tickets. But it was, it's a beautiful campus on 1,600 acres overlooking the bluffs on the Mississippi River. And I was like, you know, one of the few kids from the Chicago area to attend there. Now, it's a real four-year institution. New dorms, student population is now expected, I see, to surpass Carbondale. I mean, nowhere could I ever believe that would be the case. And I think, you know, if anything, you know, we talk about Western Illinois and Eastern Illinois, particularly during the depths of that budget impasse. But Carbondale just took a significant hit. And I don't know that Carbondale ever recovers fully.
Well, certainly what it doesn't without our help. I got to tell you, and the difference between the two was stark. Monday was the first day of class at Carbondale, and we were on campus there. And the second day of class, we were on campus at Edwardsville. And when you drive into both, you see a big difference. Edwardsville is a beautiful campus, 228,000 acres with 8 dorms and probably more going to be built. It's a wonderful campus for us that's definitely keeping students in Illinois. And I think they should be congratulated for the great work that they're doing. They're right there. They're 15, 20 minutes from Missouri. We could easily be losing those students to our neighboring state. But thankfully, they're choosing a beautiful place like Edwardsville and staying right here in Illinois. But we have to have the same thing going on in Carbondale, Rick. That school is about $1 billion, worth about $1 billion to that entire geographic region. And if we let Carbondale die, we're going to kill an entire geographic region of our state. And I don't think anyone wants to see that happen.
No, but is the animosity between these campuses and their leaders so great that, you know, I mean, this is one of those where you look at that mantra, you know, you're stronger when you're working together. And but yet, you know, you still have the animosity about funding. Carbondale still gets a 64-36% split, I believe, of the funding for the system. And, you know, there should be some modernization reflecting the increased enrollment in Edwardsville, but is it enough to really, you know, tear apart this SIU system?
I don't think tearing apart the system is really the answer. I definitely think they have to take a good, hard look at their leadership, and that starts with the Board of Trustees. That may be something that the General Assembly have to look at. Hey, maybe a new governor will have to take a serious look at it as a first order of business, because I certainly believe that the past 4 years has not helped the SIU system. You know, first and foremost, stable budgets is critically important to them and all of our universities, and to go 2.5 years without a budget was just reckless and irresponsible, and we should never have a governor who leads that effort ever again, because you're seeing in Carbondale exactly the result of that budget impasse. But I also think that the fight between the two is because, you know, the funding's just not been there coming from the state.
Well, and as you mentioned, both campuses, both beautiful campuses, obviously Carbondale, the older campus, and, you know, we've been deferring maintenance on so many things around this state, and
$600 million worth of deferred maintenance on Carbondale's campus, and it shows.
Alone. And that doesn't necessarily help entice and attract students. I mean, somewhere we got to get a capital bill approved, and somewhere we got to figure out a way to fund that.
We do. I got to tell you, now, I want people to do understand that I saw some remarkable things on the campus of Carbondale. First time in both places for me this past week, and I just love the communications building. They need to sell that place because freshmen, sophomore, juniors, and seniors are getting on camera experience in broadcasting. Their newspaper and radio programs are unbelievable. What I saw at the Paul Simon Institute and the people I met and the research that's going on and the internships available, if you're interested in politics and government, you want to be in Carbondale. And people forget, down there in Southern Illinois, there's a law school right there on the campus of SIUC. And both schools have some unique and wonderful opportunities going on, because then if you travel 90 miles over to Edwardsville, you got an amazing top nursing school, a dental school. We got some great things right here in Illinois. We just have to invest in them and help them grow.
We're speaking with State Representative Chris Welch from Hillside. He is chairman of the House Higher Education Appropriations Committee. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. (312) 981-7200 is our phone number. I'm Rick Pearson. This is your Sunday Spin. I'm here in the Allstate Skyline studio overlooking the Chicago River on Upper Wacker Drive. And on the phone is Democratic State Representative Chris Welch of Hillside. We're talking about higher ed. We've been talking specifically, more specifically, about the SIU system. But you mentioned kind of the issues of funding higher ed have, I mean, this is not just because of the two-year budget impasse, but it does go back. And I remember when Governor Blagojevich came in and proposed his first budget, and there was the unwritten rule that of any new money that the state was taking in, that two-thirds of it went to grade and high schools and a third of it went to higher ed. Governor presents his budget. There's no mention of that at all. And when I asked him about it, he said he had never heard of that before. And it just seems like higher ed has become this elite kind of thing to go to college that, I mean, it obviously we saw during the impasse with the inability to fund those monetary award program grants that, you know, that helped prompt some of this exodus out of state by a number of students, because there was no guarantee that they were going to get those MAP grants funded.
That's right. But I tell you, I think our universities would first and foremost be happy with knowing that they're going to have a stable budget year after year, because then they can do some real planning. But if they were to receive a dollar for every two that K through 12 received, they would be ecstatic to get back to that model. And one of the things that the Higher Education Working Group is going to be looking at when we convene in Bloomington this week is how do we properly fund our universities, colleges and universities, consistently with stable funding and appropriately. And because all of us know that if we're going to properly lift up the Illinois economy, we're going to do it through these colleges and universities who are going to prepare our skilled and trained workforce.
Well, yeah, and it's and this is also includes that whole issue. You know, we have all this talk about vocational training and skills training. I mean, that's an essential part of what we know as higher ed. It's not the old traditional what we thought of as college before.
Critical, critical. When I was down in Southern Illinois this week, I also stopped by John Logan Community College, and one of the things that I learned from the president was that they have a waiting list for their CTE courses. That's their vocational courses, and that's a great thing to have, and it's feeding a lot of the industry that is down there currently. And so imagine if they can leave Logan after 2 years and head over to SIUC's campus because the state's actually given them the funding to continue to build on that type of training. You know, building a skilled and trained workforce is what colleges and universities do, and we need to do our part to support it.
Well, now that we have the new funding formula for grade and high schools, it's almost, you know, seems as a time we look at some kind of a formula for our public universities and community colleges.
That's right, and that's the question we're going to be tackling this week.
Obviously, the issue comes down to money, and you know, with given the setbacks that higher ed has seen in the during the budget impasse, I mean, I can't remember what the level of funding that is in this current budget, but it's good to have a budget, but it's nowhere to where they were before.
Oh gosh, no, we're about 2% higher from 2015's level, but we're about $1 billion short of where we were in 2001. So here we are 17 years later, and we're $1 billion less. We need to probably be $1 billion more in higher education, not less, if we're going to be doing things properly. And that story is going on at campuses all over the state. Today, shortly here, I'm headed out to Champaign-Urbana. I'm going to listen to students out in the quad. I'm going to hear from the university officials later on this afternoon. I'm going to hear the same story I just heard in Southern. It's going to all come back to funding. When you're dealing with $1 billion less than you had 17 years ago, that story is going to resonate everywhere I go.
Now, you know, obviously with the University of Illinois kind of being the flagship school in the state, but, you know, lately keep hearing about, for example, the Discovery Partners Initiative that here in Chicago that's part of the University of Illinois, efforts to, you know, dramatically increase the availability of engineering and skills programs, tech programs through the University of Illinois in not just Urbana-Champaign, but Chicago, other places. You know, is there a chip on the shoulder of these other universities in the state?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that we have to support at the mothership, we call the U of I system, and with the research park in Champaign-Urbana and soon to have research park here in the Chicago area, you know, we are truly going to rival Simi Valley, and we're going to bring those companies and those jobs right here to our state. The regional universities, I call them, actually should embrace that because that's going to be more families and more bodies and students that can eventually be put into their seats in some of these regional places because there's only so much room at the U of I system. And a lot of those folks that will be at the DPI right here in the city of Chicago can feed NEIU, can feed Chicago State and UIC's campuses. I think there's nothing but positives that can come from that.
I know that the governor this past week signed the Aim High legislation, I believe it's called, but a new type of grant program for students. Could you talk about that for just a little bit?
Yes, absolutely. Thanks for that question, Rick, because you know, that opportunity, because that is one of the bills that the Higher Education Work Group produced this past legislative session. It creates a new $25 million merit scholarship program that the institutions are required to match, which makes it a $50 million merit scholarship program. And basically what we're doing is we're saying we're sick and tired of seeing Illinois students go to out-of-state schools, and we need to find a way to compete. And we believe the Merit Scholarship is certainly a way to get Illinois back in the game. We're gonna stop those kids from going to Alabama and get them into U of I or Northern or Southern or one of these Illinois schools, because they certainly have to choose an Illinois school to be eligible for the scholarship. And that was followed last week, the governor signing the 4-year MAP grant guarantee bill. So those are some things that have come out of the higher education work group that we believe are going to positively impact higher education right away.
Now, this the AIM High scholarship, that's merit-based, as you say. So it's
correct. And the MAP grant is low-income. It's based on income needs. But the AIM High is merit-based.
Which we really haven't had in a, you know, in a comprehensive way in the state before.
First time ever. It's a pilot program. I got to believe it's going to be enormously successful and eventually become a permanent program.
Well, what else is going on with the Higher Education Working Group?
Well, we start up again this week. This will be our second year of work. There was a lot of things that we left on the cutting room floor because we ran out of time last session. And we're going to pick up from there and go. We're going to look at these funding issues. Now that we've got the funding formula solved for K through 12, let's do it for higher ed. And let's look at some of these other non-funding issues that the experts tell us could possibly help. Like, does Illinois need a common application? They can go to one source and fill out an application, and all the universities receive that application, as opposed to a family having to apply to each university and pay a separate fee for each one. Let's make it easier for our students to apply and get into our colleges and universities and not make it difficult.
I like that. Boy, that could have saved me some time back in the day, filling out all those forms and everything. Wow.
When you couple that with the 175-page FAFSA application, well, you're making it a real difficult process for them.
You had to bring up the nightmare of the FAFSA application. Yes, the dreaded FAFSA application. Oh,
a simpler way to do that.
Thank goodness I'm done with those days. Democratic State Representative Chris Welch from Hillside, thank you so much for joining me this morning, and safe travels to Urbana-Champaign.
Rick, thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
We'll be back with more right after this.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. We're talking about the legal cases involving Paul Manafort and Michael Cohen. Be interesting to see how that will all turn out. In the meantime, there's still questions about whether the special counsel Robert Mueller will be able to question the president. Trump's lawyer Rudy Giuliani has been saying that he has fears that Mueller could trap Trump into saying something untrue and result in a perjury issue. But in a 1998 interview with Charlie Rose, here's what Rudy Giuliani said about presidents and perjury.
If perjury was committed, if there was a statement that turns out to be provably untrue later, then I think the president has to be treated like everyone else. Because I think under the criminal law, everybody should be treated the same.
And lying is
wrong. And I know there are people that would say the president should be treated stricter. And we used to have an era in which the president was treated much more leniently. But I think the right answer is the president should be treated, as far as the criminal law is concerned, the president's a citizen. And there, the prosecutor has to say to himself, was it material perjury?
So there you have it from Rudy Giuliani from 1998. Well, joining me now on the phone is Michael Hawthorne. He is the environmental reporter for the Chicago Tribune. I would say a seatmate, but I forget what we call these workstations now that we have at the new...
A hive or whatever,
A hive mate?
Something like that, right?
A hive mate, really? Is that what it's come down to?
Hive mate, are we in the hive? Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, man.
We're worker bees for sure, Rick.
That is for sure. But we ain't cranking out no sweet honey. That's for
no, darn sure. No. I would never. No one would ever say that of me for sure. Yes.
Well, Mike, thanks so much for joining me this morning, and I wanted to talk to you about the issue, and you know, we've been seeing it nationally too about. And this is something that Trump had campaigned on of you know, wanting to restore big coal as a energy and power source, and obviously playing to some of the politics in places like you know, West Virginia and those kind of rural economies that have not done so well. But I mean, now we have the White House basically saying each state can really decide its own coal rules and throwing the Obama Clean Power Plan completely out the window.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable, but it's not surprising in the sense that, like what you said, you know, people like Mitch McConnell from Kentucky, the Republican Party in general has had this this rhetoric for many years that that the Obama administration, that environmental regulators in general are engaged in, you know, in their slogan war on coal. You know, the fine print, of course, is a heck of a lot more nuanced and complicated than that. And if anything is a war on coal, it's other forms of energy that are providing American jobs, like natural gas and wind and solar power. And I the way I look at this almost always is that it's like it's a version of the old Watergate era follow the money adage. Really what we're engaged with here is, you know, a massive transition in the way that we as Americans get our electricity. And there are a number of companies out there that are vying to be the, you know, the money makers in that venture. And coal has been king. They were king for a very long time. They're on the way out, regulations or not, because they can't compete in power markets the way that power markets are devised today. So they're kind of dancing all around the margins here, and they have a Congress and a president right now who seems to be all too willing to give them what they want. I think the real question is whether it actually moves the needle at all for coal. Most smart analysts, you know, financial analysts, industry analysts, would say it's probably not going to do too much. And I think the interesting thing here is you hear a lot of talk about the Obama rules being overreach. That's another part of the rhetoric. You could also look at it just in terms of how carbon dioxide emissions have gone in Illinois and other traditionally coal-dependent states like Ohio and Indiana, Alabama, even Georgia, Tennessee, you know, places that where coal was the dominant source of electricity for a long time. All of these states, including Illinois, have already met the targets of the Obama Clean Power Plan. So that, to me, says that, if anything, the Obama rules weren't that strong at all. They were more a nudge than a cudgel. And, you know, that's a reflection of where energy is heading, and it's not headed toward coal.
Well, I mean, and I think what you're saying goes to what I was always thinking, is that, you know, coal was always being phased out. And even without the Obama rules, I mean, obviously, there have always been the health concerns and particularly the high sulfur coal. I mean, obviously, sure. we know that in Illinois.
Yep. But beyond that, just, you know, if you look at, you know, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you know, keeps track of jobs in various industries, and the coal mining jobs fell off a cliff starting roughly when Ronald Reagan was elected president. And it had nothing to do with Reagan or really even pollution regulations at that point. What it had to do with was automation.
Right.
And so a lot of, you know, out west, that's where they, you know, a lot of coal is mined out west. It's mined with giant machines. And now even in Illinois, it's interesting, you know, Illinois used to have a lot of coal mining jobs, and you and I both know we've been in these towns that have been, you know, heavily dependent on coal for so long. you know, the coal is still being mined. There's a heck of a lot of coal coming out of Illinois mines. It's just not being mined by workers. It's being mined by machines. And so production, actually, in Illinois is actually increased in recent years, but the number of people mining it has gone down significantly.
And that further raises some of those political issues, even though, you know, the president is, you know, let's bring back big coal. It doesn't mean that there's going to be jobs that go with it.
Oh, I agree. I think really you can look at this in large part. This is being done, for the industry as a whole. And when we're talking industry, we're talking the executive suites of the industry. And in particular, the number one cheerleader and the person who's been out there very aggressively, essentially telling President Trump what to do is Bob Murray from Murray Energy Corporation based in Ohio. Bob Murray now owns a good chunk of Illinois coal as well. He's a controlling interest in a company called Foresight Energy now. And they mine a lot of coal in southern Illinois. Once again, most of it's done by machines underground and very few workers. And also mostly, I think, exclusively non-union labor as well. So, the jobs don't necessarily pay as much, but it is true in those counties, those mines can still be a pretty big employer. So that says something about the economy of some of these rural southern Illinois counties. And that's why, you know, we saw when our old friend Rod Blagojevich was governor, you know, that's he played to that part of the state by talking up coal. And interestingly enough, Illinois already meets the clean power plant goal that that President Obama put in place. We also have designation or whatever the interesting historical footnote. We might have the last big power plant built in America in history in southern Illinois, the Prairie State plant that was built by Peabody Coal, right, in St. Louis, and now a lot of suburbs like Naperville and St. Charles and Wilmette and hundreds of other towns across the Midwest are on the hook for, because they're paying off the debt for building that very expensive coal plant.
We're speaking with Michael Hawthorne, my colleague at the Chicago Tribune. He's our environmental reporter. We're talking about the Trump administration and reversing the Obama Clean Power Plan. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. We're speaking with Mike Hawthorne, my Tribune colleague, environmental writer and reporter at the Tribune. We're talking about the politics of coal, basically, I think. Is that the best way to put it, Mike?
Yeah, I think so. Go ahead, Rick. Yeah.
Well, one of the things, and you kind of touched on this in the beginning of our conversation, is about markets. And, you know, you note, look at natural gas, look at these alternative energy sources. I mean, who it really is using coal these days?
Well, there are some companies that still burn coal. It's an interesting thing, and it's an interesting thing that hasn't really come up in the governor's race here in Illinois. But there's a version, like a kind of a state version of what Trump's trying to do here in Illinois, and this is something that Governor Bruce Rauner's done with regard to eight really aging coal plants in central and southern Illinois that can't compete. They're increasingly having trouble competing in electricity markets. And so what Governor Rauner's administration has tried to do is relax pollution standards for coal plants in the state. And this company now, it used to be called Dynegy. A lot of the plants used to be Illinois Power. Now they're owned by a company called Vistra, which is another Texas-based company. These power plants, some of them have even they've got all the bells and whistles in terms of pollution control. So they do everything that the Environmental Protection Agency regulations for, things like acid rain forming,
scrubbers and that kind of thing.
Yes, well, they've got all the bells and whistles, and yet they still can't do well or make money in electricity markets. And so what the Rauner administration is trying to do is kind of finagle the way that state regulations limit smog-forming pollution. And they're having trouble getting that through the Illinois Pollution Control Board, even though Rauner's appointees control that board, because the numbers show that there would be, essentially the Rauner rules would allow these Dynegy coal plants to emit a heck of a lot more pollution than they do today. And I want to then segue back to the Trump plan. I'm just amazed by, maybe we shouldn't be surprised by, what I'm amazed by is the Trump administration's coal rules, by their very admission, if you read the technical analysis document that I and other reporters have on those rules, it would actually lead to an increase in pollution. And the Trump EPA even comes out and says it would actually lead to more deaths. More Americans would die if these rules take effect. And so that just kind of, makes your head spin when you read something like that, because it's being promoted as this amazing thing for, as the president puts it, beautiful, clean coal. But really what it would do would be, it would kill more Americans. I don't know if I've ever seen anyone in American politics campaign on something where they weren't.
Yep. Sorry, Mike.
Boggles the mind.
Well, it lost you there for just a second, but yeah, I mean, that to me was kind of a very damning admission of the, I believe it was 1,400. I'm not sure what the number was.
Yeah, a year roughly. Yes, right. So it's essentially, that's, if these plants kept emitting pollution and in some cases increasing the amount of pollution, the estimation would be that more Americans would die from inhaling, the fine particles that get into your lungs and science shows trigger heart attacks and respiratory diseases and lead to early death.
Well,
and it's not a coincidence that all the science that says that this stuff is very dangerous, that the Trump EPA, both Pruitt and Andrew Wheeler, the acting head of the EPA under the Trump administration, they want to get rid of all of those standards in terms of using them for rulemaking.
You actually said that it hasn't really come out much in the governor's campaign, but lately, as the governor has been spending more time downstate, including now he's over at the DuQuoin State Fair in Southern Illinois. He was on a radio station in Marion the other day, where he noted, in his words, that Democratic challenger J.B. Pritzker was a supporter of Hillary Clinton, big supporter of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, and the leaders of the war on coal. So...
we've seen a number of things from the governor recently, right, that he's trying to make up with the conservative base in the Republican Party, and culturally coal still does well, it seems like, in historically coal dependent counties, even if the jobs aren't there. So it seems to me like it's been wrapped up into the culture wars in another way, that it's a litmus test now to be a Republican politician, not only in Illinois, but in the country as a whole. You have to love coal. But what does that actually mean?
Well, indeed, I think we'll be touching on that partially as well with our next guest after the news, Professor John Jackson from Southern Illinois University, as we talk about the politics of regionalism. But certainly coal kind of exemplifies the kind of that politics of regionalism as well.
True, very true. But once again, that pollution, the coal plant pollution, you know, it affects people in those counties as well in terms of their health. And I think it's important to note that those power plants, those coal-fired power plants downstate, don't almost to a number. They don't burn Illinois coal. They all burn coal from Wyoming. So it's not like if the mines, you know, if the power plants closed, it wouldn't affect Illinois coal mining employment necessarily, because once again they're having it shipped in on this endless stream of rail cars and barges from Wyoming, and this is even the plants that have been thoroughly scrubbed and all the things that, you know, that the coal industry told Southern Illinoisans that's why you know, the jobs were, you know, they right. were put out of business. It was really the utilities that didn't want to spend the money on the pollution control equipment that eventually the government made them install. And by then, though, it was too late for the poor miners downstate.
That's Michael Hawthorne, environmental reporter for the Chicago Tribune on the politics of coal. Mike, thanks as always. Have a great Sunday.
Thanks, Rick.
We'll be back with more right after this.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. Several Democratic senators have postponed meeting with the president's Supreme Court pick, Brett Kavanaugh, because of these recent activities going on in federal court involving Trump associates. Trump continues to taunt his attorney general, Jeff Sessions. But Illinois Senior Senator Dick Durbin, a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, he met with Kavanaugh. Still, Durbin says Republicans should release documents from Kavanaugh's time as staff secretary to President George W. Bush.
During the period of time when he was serving as the president's staff secretary, about issues that he worked on. Those issues included, for example, the Bush administration's endorsement in 2004 of a proposal to amend the Constitution to ban same-sex marriage. Would the thoughts and writings of Brett Kavanaugh on that subject be important for us to review in light of his nomination to the Supreme Court? Of course they would. The Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act, enacted in November of 2003. The Iraq War and the abuses at Abu Ghraib. The Supreme Court's nomination of John Roberts, Harriet Myers, and Samuel Alito. A score of cases that came before the Supreme Court on critical issues related to detainees and others. Warrantless wiretapping of American citizens, which he specifically recalled was an issue that he had to discuss specifically with the president. The national security letters of the Patriot Act, Second Amendment gun laws, affirmative action, the list goes on. The point I'm making here is that 35-month period of time where Brett Kavanaugh served as staff secretary to President Bush was a period of time that was rife with issues of great constitutional moment. It's the reason why the American people have a right to know what he said, how he advised the president, what he wrote. Those are things which the Republicans are hiding from the American people and keeping secret.
That's Illinois Senior U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. Well, we're going to bring things a little bit more closer to home. We're going to talk to, speaking right now on the phone, is Professor John Jackson from Southern Illinois University and a member of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute. And Professor Jackson is the co-author of a report from the Simon Institute, The Politics of Public Budgeting in Illinois. Now, okay, it's an okay title, but I like The Politics of Regionalism, Professor. How about that?
That would be a better title, actually. Wish we'd thought of it.
Well, and certainly that's the way I took it. And, you know, the release of this report coming out as, you know, we're into kind of a traditional downstate kind of campaign mode for candidates for governor, coming off of the Illinois State Fair, moving over now this weekend and into the DuQuoin State Fair. And, you know, there's no doubt that politicians on both sides have tried to play off the divisions in the state and the kind of the feeling among folks in Southern Illinois, Central Illinois, Western Illinois, where, you know, Macomb is known as Forgottonia among some of those folks. But just this feeling that, you know, it's Chicago gets everything. And, you know, we are seeing it in this campaign, particularly with Governor Rauner. But there's a lot more to the story than just that kind of regional chip on the shoulder, because there's some money involved.
We think regionalism is sort of the bane of Illinois politics in many ways, and it emphasizes what divides us more than what unites us. And I think downstate in general, and particularly in deep southern Illinois, we feel a sense of that perhaps more than Chicago gets, because we just get so much emphasis on it. DeQuoin State Fair is on right now, of course, and all politicians on both sides are here. And down here, we constantly hear how all the resources go to Chicago, and Northeast Illinois is the bane of our existence and the source of all of our problems and so forth. And we take an empirical look at that. We think some facts should inform this debate, and the facts are that we do quite all right in downstate in terms of the amount of money we pay into taxes as opposed to what we get back in state returns to the local areas. So we think fact is better than fiction, and fact is superior to the myth.
But will that change anything?
Well, it's a very small voice, and they have a much bigger megaphone than we do. And, of course, those campaign ads and the debate over the budget, which was so loud and went on for well over 2 years, illustrates this. And the debate over the school funding formula, of course, and whether or not Chicago school system was getting an unfair bailout. All of that resonates across the state. And, you know, there's relatively little that binds Illinois together as a state, and particularly when the leadership emphasizes these divisive themes.
Well, and I mean, let's face it, that was part of the great heritage of Illinois here in our bicentennial year, is the diversity of this state.
Well, diversity is not necessarily divisive and shouldn't be. Diversity can indeed be a strength if it's not
exploited.
Exploited.
I mean, well, let's talk a little bit about the findings in this study. Is that you know, taxes and spending are not equally distributed across the state. Suburban counties generate about twice as much in taxes as they receive in direct state spending. Cook County and Chicago closer to breaking even. Meanwhile, downstate Illinois, where Chicago and the Chicagoland area is often being portrayed as evil, downstate Illinois, the 96, quote, downstate counties as a group, receive about 50% more in state spending than they contribute in tax revenue. That's a stunning figure. And it's particularly stunning when, you know, even to this day, we still have people talking about, let's split up the state and Chicago should be its own state and all that kind of thing. Well, I mean, that's a stunning number to look at.
Well, one of the things that impressed us was there was a Democratic governor candidate in the primaries in March who ran on a platform of dividing the state, turning it into two or five states, and getting rid of Chicago and getting rid of Northeast Illinois. And basically, that's something that comes around again and again. You mentioned Western Illinois and Fargatonia earlier. All of that is endemic to Illinois politics and has been for many, many years, if not forever. It's deeply ingrained in our political culture. Our quick response to that is, if we did that, Southern Illinois and Central Illinois would be Mississippi North, basically.
We're speaking with Professor John Jackson from Southern Illinois University, a member of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute, and co-author of a research paper, The Politics of Public Budgeting in Illinois. We'll be back with more right after this. ¶¶ Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. We're speaking with Professor John Jackson from Southern Illinois University, part of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute. We're talking about a paper he co-authored that kind of gets into this whole issue of politicians playing regionalism in Illinois. And, you know, in this research, you note that regional pride, regional jealousy, that's not an unusual factor in many states, particularly ones that have a kind of a dominant urban area. But you go on to say what is different, or at least exaggerated in Illinois, however, is the extent to which many Illinois leaders emphasize, exploit, and exacerbate these regional differences for their own advantage. As a prime example, running against Chicago. And so, you know, as we constantly see from a Republican aspect, it's trying to take Chicago Democratic leaders, portray them as corrupt and part of the Chicago machine. That's the shorthand of regionalism there. And, you know, here again, playing on these kind of long-standing perceptions that every 4 years, sometimes every 2 years in legislative races, are just allowed to proliferate. Am I right?
Yes, that's exactly right. I think you can see down here that playing out in various ways, but most notably in terms of, since I've lived here, which is 40 years now, we started with, we're supposed to hate and fear Mayor Richard J. Daley because he's always dictating and he's always getting his way. And then it moved to Richard M., and same story, but somehow maybe a little less virulent, but nevertheless, he was the bad guy. And now, of course, it's transitioned to constantly Mike Madigan. And I think that's a form of the same thing for us in downstate, really, but it's the shorthand, and that shorthand then gets into all of the commercials and all the television and becomes reinforced constantly.
Well, and let's make no secret, you know, Illinois is a huge state, and when you get into your area around Carbondale and you know, when you're, you know, pretty much closer to Memphis than you are to Chicago, there are going to be different regional attitudes and regional concerns. You know, for example, one thing is kind of the, I would say, and you're much closer to this than I am, but is the more turn towards red in downstate in southern, deep southern Illinois, where, you know, it used to be you'd have blue dog Democrats there. In fact, going to my previous guest, Mike Hawthorne, and we were talking about coal country, and you had some of the influence of the United Mine Workers and electing Democrats down in coal country. That's all kind of going away.
Well, that's exactly right. And we've gone through the same transition that the South has gone through. We lagged the South and were a good deal later getting to that, but we have certainly come to that party. And we've become increasingly red in presidential votes and even in congressional votes now. And this end of the state, particularly because of economic reasons, was always a bastion of Democratic strength. And the unions were a key part of that. And the same thing that's happened to the South has happened here, although ours came more recently.
And doesn't that actually even further exacerbate that regional split, because it's now it's Chicago Democrats against Republicans in the rest of the state? We kind of saw it in the, you know, in the last election for governor.
Well, I think that's right. And what it does is to reflect how much Illinois is a microcosm of national politics. We are a deeply polarized nation, and we're polarized ideologically and partisanship and geographically. And now Illinois reflects almost exactly that same distribution. Look at the distribution of counties that went for Trump versus counties that went for Clinton. In fact, it looks the same as the national distribution.
Well, and you bring up a good point too, because in that 2016 race, and I've made the point repeatedly, is that, you know, the enhanced role, I think, of the suburbs and the collar counties. And even if you want to take it even a step further, perhaps the role of moderate suburban women in determining the fate of statewide candidacies. And I think, you know, when you look at that 2016 race for president, here you have the collar counties, which were traditionally part of the Republican firewall to offset votes, Democratic votes coming out of the city. The firewall is being burnt through. You had all but McHenry County and the collar counties supported Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. And I think, you know, that's, people are kind of wondering now, how does that play out now when we get to the 2018 midterms?
Exactly. It used to be that there was a thesis that downstate sort of had the balance of power, and as goes downstate, so goes Illinois elections. Well, that's not really the case anymore. Downstate is pretty dependably going to be red if you look at distribution by county. Chicago, of course, is going to be blue. And then the game is won, whether it's federal or statewide out there in the suburbs. DuPage County used to be the bastion of pure Republican strength, and it's much more diverse, and the suburbs are much more diverse now.
Yeah, I think demographically, but also ideologically, because, you know, the type of Republican politics that we've seen in this state for decades, of more of a, I guess, social moderate fiscal conservative, that's kind of being upended ideologically by what you're seeing coming from the Trump administration.
Well, and that too is a microcosm of the suburban influence in national elections. You can pander to the base on either side, and pandering to the base for either side will get you
X
35,
amount, right.
Maybe 40%, but it's tough to get to 50%. And to get to 50%, you've got to have independent, moderate, and uncommitted voters, and those are often found in the suburbs.
We'll watch as the governor's race plays out. We'll be watching, of course, plenty of these midterm congressional elections playing out. Certainly, you know, plenty of interesting races going on. We look, obviously, at the congressional races here in the suburbs, but also some very interesting ones downstate. And we'll see what becomes of all that talk about a blue wave or not. Professor John Jackson from Southern Illinois University, Carbondale, from the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute. Professor, thank you so much for joining me this Sunday morning. Hope to have you back on again.
Thanks. Glad to do it.
We'll be back with more right after this. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, Democratic State Representative Chris Welch from Hillside, Mike Hawthorne, my colleague at Chicago Tribune, and SIU Carbondale Professor John Jackson. Most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening. And now it's time to turn things over on Triathlon Sunday.
Woo-hoo!
To my favorite triathlete.
Good. I'm pumped.
Dean Richard, I knew you would be.
I'm pumped.
Yes, we were just discussing the hurdling competition on a Lower Wacker Drive. We'll leave it at that. You can imagine.
For our DVD WGN After Dark that'll one day will be coming out. There's a lot of people in spandex walking around in downtown Chicago today.
I don't know how
normally
to respond to that.
Normally
one.
We would make fun of them if we were at
street level.
In the old dump where we used to be.
Right.
But now, you know, we can only see them from a distance up here, but just coming into the building this morning, everyone's in spandex. Everyone, they have their bicycles, they have their all their stuff for the triathlon stuff that you do.
I was speaking earlier, I can't imagine this is like the preferred triathlete weather, you know, with the humidity.
It's a little humid, yeah.
Yeah, it would be like just a pure swimming competition.
I would think.
Ooh.
I would think.
Ooh.
Yeah. That's why I've spent the morning just drinking coffee.
Yeah, keeping fluids, yeah. Right?
Yes. Coffee,
yeah.
Sweet rolls, and bacon. That's my triathlon
okay,
this
good.
Morning.
All right, good.
That's
good.
My triathlon of goodness on a Sunday morning. This morning we've got all the regular features. We've got a special guest who will join us in a couple of minutes. And, of course, this morning also we're going to be remembering Senator John McCain. Passed away last night. We've got Senator Dick Durbin, among others, who will be joining us later in the show today to remember his old pal and adversary at the same time. It should be some pretty interesting conversation and reminiscences.
I'll be tuning in. It's really, you know, we knew it was coming. But just the enormity of his career, and the various facets of that career.
Yeah. CNN, I mean, all the news operations, I imagine, have had plenty of time to build obituaries, but they ran what appeared to be part of a documentary that came out a couple of years ago that was fascinating. I mean, I learned so many things about Senator McCain's life that I didn't know. We'll talk about some of those things coming up.
I'll be listening
a little bit later on this morning. The Steve Cochran Show celebrates the most valuable person on the planet weekday mornings at 7:20 on 7:20 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users say play WGN radio on TuneIn.